Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with Aaron Fitt, I'm John Manuel. Thank you so much for joining us here on baseballamerica.com or via iTunes with our weekly college baseball podcast. And we also want to remind you a couple of great things that we've started at Baseball America here in 2011. The mobile Baseball America, we have a new mobile site, better late than never. You can either go just to regular Baseball America on your iPad or your iPod Touch, iPhones. We do have a mobile-enabled site. If you're on a BlackBerry, m.baseballamerica.com is your new mobile browser for Baseball America, so we want to make sure we remind people about that. And also, Aaron, I'm not sure if you've tested this out, but our Baseball America Digital Edition. The Digital Edition brings you the magazine on the go. You no longer have to wait by the mailbox for the latest issue to arrive. Every 2 weeks, you're notified by email that a new Digital Edition is available for download. It's you can get it for as low as $1.76 per issue at baseballamerica.com/subscribe. And the Minor League Preview Edition, we are actually, I believe, sponsored by Rawlings, have a free edition of the Digital Edition that's available at baseballamerica.com. So I want to remind people of that, especially for our college listeners, Aaron. I don't think everybody who follows the college stuff necessarily subscribes, but a lot of college subscriber content as well, especially player features. And this issue, the midseason update, is actually what's going to be in the magazine. A lot of that's already out, but midseason now, Aaron, we're past that with 8 weeks. Things are starting to shape up, and we'll start off on the SEC, where Vanderbilt and South Carolina get a little bit of a closer, tighter grip on the top two spots in that league. They're tied for first in the SEC East as Florida falls a step behind because they didn't sweep. And really, Vanderbilt and South Carolina, those two teams right now, Aaron, are just machines. I mean, South Carolina with its pitching, allowing fewer than two runs per game over the last, like, 3 weeks. And Vanderbilt entertains Alabama this weekend, the SEC West winner that had won seven of its first nine league games. And they just crushed the Crimson Tide, a very impressive series sweep for Vanderbilt. How far ahead of the rest of the league do you think South Carolina and Vanderbilt are? Have they put some distance between them and Florida in your minds, or is Florida still in that same group for you?
You know, Florida's still in that same group for me. For me, it's those three teams and then a huge gap, the way it has been all year long. You know, I don't think a one-game cushion over Florida really is enough for me. I mean, you know, Florida did win a road series this weekend against Mississippi State. You know, I think they're still right in the mix. But those three teams, to me, all look like they're going to be national seeds in the SEC, and that's amazing. Three national seeds potentially coming out of one division in the SEC, all in the SEC East. And the interesting thing now about the SEC also is – you know, Georgia all of a sudden is starting to look like it might be as good as any of the teams in the West. So that's a fourth SEC East team. I mean, Georgia's now 8-4 in the conference. They've really gotten hot since starting slow. And you know, they've got a better record than any team in the West.
That is amazing, and I'm glad you brought up the Georgia Bulldogs because, you know, so much has been that's just a team that gets talked about a lot. There's no middle ground. They're like a great fantasy team. They either are right there in the national championship mix or they stink, you know, so they're going to draft high the next year. That works great in fantasy, not so much in college baseball. Only 18-15 overall, Aaron, but they're a team that's hot, number one. Number two, their series losses look a little bit better, like getting swept by Stetson. You still don't want to get swept, but Stetson's in our top 25. Series losses to Baylor and Florida State are certainly understandable. They lost a series to South Carolina, but they were competitive in that series. Now they've, you know, won their last three conference series. Georgia looks like a regional team. How much of a test can they give Florida this weekend? They're home to the Gators. Obviously, a big rivalry series from the football Georgia Florida rivalry. What does Georgia do that can give Florida problems this weekend?
Well, for one thing, you know, Michael Palazzone on Saturdays has been terrific. I mean, I think he's really taken that step forward that Georgia needed him to take this year. And, you know, Alex Wood on Fridays gives him a chance to win every time out. Although he wasn't great this past weekend, he still won, battled, you know, Georgia scored a bunch of runs on Friday. So, you know, the offense seems like it's starting to come around a little bit for Georgia. You know, you're seeing, you know, Zach Cohn had a decent weekend, you know. There's still some pieces that haven't come together for them, but you know, it's getting there. It's come a long way from the start of the season, and I think it's gonna be an interesting series. I mean, obviously, I still like Florida, but you know, it's good to see Georgia has really rallied after, you know, the thing with Jonathan Taylor, losing him to that serious spinal injury. They didn't let that get them down. You know, last year they really struggled after they lost Chance Veazey, and you know, a lot of people on that team have said that losing a teammate who was paralyzed was devastating for them, and it's hard. It's easy to understand why that would take a toll on a team. But this year, they just said, we're doing this for Taylor, and you know, and let's just go out there and play.
Yeah, it really seems like that's they just turned things around considerably. Since that injury, and it just seemed like that maybe the team was able to put aside some other issues, or if they had any other issues. I mean, it's hard to know without being there. But the one thing that you can really see is that they're pitching a lot better this year than they did last year. That seems like that's a huge. And you mentioned Palazzone. Looks like Blake Dietrich is another big story for them. The sophomore, I just remember reading something about him online earlier this year. And he had, 44 walks, I think it was, last year in 25 innings. And now this year he's kind of become their moment of truth guy in the bullpen, and he's become a workhorse, and he's throwing more strikes. And just that whole pitching staff, I mean, like Palazzone with the 3 walks and 55 innings, I mean, he wasn't close to that kind of a factor the last couple of years. So I'm really glad you brought up Georgia, because they're one of the best stories in the SEC. And like you said, I mean, if they were in the West, that 8-5 record, 8-4 record would be good enough for first place in the SEC West. We've talked a lot about the SEC West already this year, Aaron. This week, the team that stepped forward is Arkansas. I think in the preseason, we had Arkansas either maybe 2 in the SEC West behind LSU. Yeah. It seemed like those two teams played a very tight series this weekend. One of the games on national TV I got to watch on Saturday night. I think a lot of people watched that game who are college baseball fans. And we got to see James McCann with that dramatic walk-off 3-run home run. And you really see one of the biggest reasons why LSU is at 3-9 and last place in the West. Their closer situation is just not settled. This weekend they tried Kevin Berry, the transfer from New Orleans. Previously, obviously, they had Matty Ott. Matty Ott is just not the same guy he was in 2009. For whatever reason, he's not as effective, not nearly as effective. And LSU doesn't seem like they're able to come back from that, Aaron. 3-9, can the Tigers rally from 3-9? And are they a regional team at this point?
I still think they're a regional team because they're going to have such a great RPI. They've got a home series this weekend against Auburn that's winnable. They've got home series left against Kentucky and Tennessee. They should be able to – I mean, in theory, they could sweep all those series, but you figure they'll probably – they'll probably go 6-3 in those games, maybe 7-2 or better. But, I mean, I think that helps a lot. And they still have that series win against Cal – the sweep against Cal State Fullerton. That's going to help them a lot at the end of the year. It doesn't look like they're gonna rebound to win the SEC West, but you never know. Even that is not a reach, and they're still only 4 games back. You know, even at 3-9, they're only 4 games back in their own division. So,
what do you think they have to do? Just they've played 12 games. They've got 18 games left in the league. What do you think they have to do the rest of the year? With their 23, 25 games left. You know, what kind of record do you think they have to get to be a regional team?
Well,
doesn't sound like it has to be that ambitious. I mean, like in your mind, if they go 13-12, and over those last 18 games they go say 12-6, 11-5 in the SEC, is that going to be enough?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if they're in the SEC tournament, they're in for sure as a regional team.
Well, that's actually that bar is a little bit lower though this year, is it not? I mean, they take the top 3 teams from each division, right? Or just the top 2 teams? Not sure which it is there, but I mean that bar is not that high for making the SEC for making the SEC tournament from the West.
From the West,
like is Alabama a lock? If they finish 500 in the league, is their non-conference schedule enough for them to get in?
I think so. I still think that any team that makes the SEC tournament is going to be in a regional this year, because you know for one thing, as we've talked about. It's hard to get to 64 teams, you know, and feel good about them. And all those teams are going to have strong RPIs in the SEC. And I think if you win enough games to make the SEC tournament, I think you're going to be fine.
I start to wonder at what point the SEC West team's RPI doesn't improve as much as maybe we expect it to, because some of the teams in the SEC do not have great win-loss records. Kentucky's under 500. Georgia's win-loss record is not great. Tennessee's lost 13 games. They're headed for under 500. Let's face it, 2-10 in the league. They're not playing well. You know, Auburn's 18-14. at some point, if you have a bunch of 500 teams in that league, it's going to drag their league RPI down from the lofty levels that we would expect it. I would think it would start to have some kind of a drag. I could be wrong, but I have to imagine that it's going to have to start having some kind of drag on that league's RPIs. It's not an impressive-looking league right now. It's a three-team league, and right now if I had to pick a fourth best team in the league, I might pick Georgia, Aaron, because Arkansas, as well as they played this weekend, they pitched well this weekend. Still seems like their pitching picture is a little unsettled. What went right for them on the mound this weekend that allowed them to sweep LSU?
Well, you know, for one thing, they moved DJ Baxendale back into the Friday starter spot, which I think works. I think they need to have that anchor at the start of the rotation. And, you know, I understand why they moved him into the bullpen, especially after they lost Jeffrey Davenport. They kind of needed that moment of truth guy. But I think he fit well at the top of the rotation. And then they got a nice start from Brandon Moore the next day, 5 scoreless innings. But their bullpen came up pretty big for them this weekend too. You know, every day, you know, they got 4 or so strong innings from their bullpen. And that's going to have to be a key for them, obviously.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. They just need to settle, it seems like, in the weekend rotation. And maybe the success they had this weekend will allow them to do that. And their bullpen performed, seemed like, fairly well this weekend. Obviously, they gave up a late lead. Not a late lead, but they gave up some late runs on Saturday. But, you know, Aaron, have you noticed any correlation this year with teams when they have some success offensively? Have teams been able to carry that over once they start to have a little success with the bats? We saw that a little bit this week out of Arkansas. They got some big hits. I don't know if you've anecdotally noticed that with other teams. I probably should talk about the midseason trends report a little bit here on the podcast. Have you noticed anything like that anecdotally about teams that once they do have a decent weekend offensively, that they start to gain a little confidence from that?
You know, I think that happens sometimes, but I think there's other cases where, you know, a team will have a great weekend and think that they're turning the corner, and then it just, their momentum gets stopped in their tracks. I mean, I don't think it's like it used to be with the old bats, where you can get on a roll and just ride the hot streak. I think it's a lot harder to sustain that now. But you know, I wonder how it's going to work. I mean, a guy like, you know, like Keith Werman at Virginia had struggled most of the year, had a big weekend this past weekend. Is he going to be able to keep that going now? I mean, is there something that, you just figure out with the bats, you know, or just have to be really locked in? I mean, I don't know yet. Nobody really knows, how to take these bats. And, you know, there's a lot of questions that they bring up.
I think that the key is to not overthink it. To me, it's oversimplifying it maybe, but it performs like wood. That was their goal. It performs like wood. You have to have strength to have a consistent swing and to get the fat part of the bat on the ball. And if you don't if you don't have any strength in your swing, you're going to really struggle with these bats. And I think that's why a guy like Keith Werman has struggled. And I think once you realize that as a hitter and you're able to make that adjustments and not rely just on your hands but use your lower half in your swing, you're going to be able to drive the ball. And I think that's, you know, that's what we saw. I tweeted about it, but we were both talking about your personal cheese ball, James McCann. He did that on Saturday on that line drive swing that he had earlier in the game, and then he had the you know, the home run, the game-winning home run later. But let's talk a little bit, Aaron. Before we go on to Virginia, you mentioned Keith Werman. Let's talk a little bit about this midseason trends report, because I think we have to – it hasn't been the elephant in the room. We've talked about the offense all year. But, God, I mean, did you realize that – I think we realized scoring was down that much. I think I almost thought the home runs were down even more. They're basically cut in half from 0.94 home runs per game in 2010 to 0.47 home runs per game early in the year. And usually it seems like those offensive numbers – gain ground over the second half of the season historically. So maybe they'll creep up a little bit as the year goes on.
Yeah, I think it's better to compare the midseason from last year with the midseason from this year, which I think is on there as well.
Right, it is. I agree. But, I mean, the number of shutouts, that last year there were 277 shutouts in the first half of the year, and this year 444 shutouts. That is just so eye-opening. I mean, I think we've tried to prepare people that pitching and defense was going to matter more with these bats. Did the numbers still surprise you or impress you that they were that dramatic?
It's stark, isn't it? I mean, the shutout number, like you mentioned to me, that leapt off the page, and it has felt like we've seen a lot of shutouts, and you know, it seems we've had kind of a slew of no hitters, and you know, we had that perfect game, and it just seems like it's a lot easier to just dominate on the mound than it used to be, and you don't even have to have overpowering stuff like we've talked about. You know, you throw strikes, that's a huge part of the battle. Let your defense do the job behind you. So, yeah, I mean. You know, I think defense, like we wrote about at length in the preseason, I think defense is really, really, really important now because, you know, strikeout rate is about the same as it was last year.
Right.
You know, people are still putting the ball on play, but the batting average on balls in play has gone way down because, you know, they're just not hitting the ball as hard. And so you've got to be able to take advantage of all the opportunities you have to make outs. Defensively, and on the other side, you have to be able to take advantage of any opportunity you have to manufacture runs. So, you know, I think it's you still need to be able to hit. You still need to have some guys with the strength to swing these bats and score some runs. But you also really need to be able to defend. You need to be able to do everything. It's you know, let's face it. There's no magic bullet. I don't think.
Well, I think that's it, Aaron. I think that's a great point. The well-rounded teams. I've been the better teams this year. Vanderbilt and Virginia. And South Carolina and Florida, these are very well-rounded teams. And let's transition. You mentioned Keith Worman earlier. Let's talk about Virginia. I think the two most impressive series of the weekend. There are three series that jumped out at me in the country. Two of them were in the ACC. One of them was Oregon State in the Pac-10, sweeping Arizona State. But the other two, to me, though, the most impressive series were North Carolina and Virginia going on the road to sweep impressive teams. North Carolina going – not sweep, I misspoke. Virginia going on the road to win a series at Georgia Tech, then North Carolina going on the road to win a series at Florida State. Let's talk about the Cavaliers first. That's a little bit less surprising because they were ranked second, Georgia Tech 14th. But to me, the only difference between these two teams is that Virginia is a much more veteran team than Georgia Tech, only because most teams are much more veteran than Georgia Tech. They've been so reliant on freshmen. But what was Virginia able to do to put up 18 runs on Mark Pope and Jed Bradley and the Georgia Tech bullpen? That Georgia Tech had pitched so well all year. Why was Virginia able to get to them?
Well, you know, I tell you, Virginia just has a really, you know, a good patient approach. They take what's given to you. You know, it's for the most part, it's not an offense that's going to bludgeon you. But they have gotten some timely home runs. I mean, David Coleman had a big one, a three-run shot on Friday against Pope, I believe. You know, and they showed some more power on Saturday. But you know, it's really an offense that's built a lot like it was last year. You know, it's drive you crazy with wearing out the gaps and getting on base and. You know, that's kind of the unsung hero of Virginia's team. We talk a lot about their pitching, I think, because their pitching is really good. But, boy, they sure can score some runs, too. And they've got some depth, you know. I mean, one of the reasons they haven't been hitting Danny Holson lately is because Jared King has kind of emerged. And, you know, they've got Kenny Swab in there. And they've got all these different guys that they can, you know, Ryan Levine, rather, you know, has done a good job. I mean, they've got a lot of different parts that they can mix around. And you know, I think Chris Taylor has been a key for them at the leadoff spot all year. He's really been a catalyst guy for them. You know, I think Virginia has proven that it's the team to beat in the ACC at this point because they now won a road series against Georgia Tech. They swept Clemson on the road. They won a home series against Florida State. You know, their resume is impeccable. You know, and they're 31-3 overall. I mean, I think I now believe in North Carolina as well, but I'm more convinced than ever that Virginia is the class of that league.
I think you said it perfectly, that they have taken care of probably the toughest part of their schedule. They've already played Florida State. They've already played Georgia Tech. And, you know, obviously you look at the rest of their league schedule. Their next three series are Duke, NC State, Boston College. If they don't sweep those three series, two of those are at home. If they don't sweep those three series, I'll be stunned. And they could be 42-3 because they've got Richmond and VCU, Georgetown, Coastal Carolina. They could have a pretty ridiculous record, Aaron, when it comes down to it. And they're home to Miami and at North Carolina. The only series the rest of the year where they're not going to be favored is at North Carolina. And even there, they could be they have no team in the country other than Vanderbilt and South Carolina has taken care of business more than Virginia. And it's just I think you hit it earlier when we talked about the bats. They are. You've talked about it all year. You better be gap to gap. You know, like the way that Elliot Avent put it to me this year, early and under used to work, does not work anymore. If your swing is early because you're looking to pull and under because you're looking to lift the ball and get it in the air, you will make outs. In the past, you would hit home runs. So if you work the gaps, you're going to have success. And nothing says work the gaps more than Virginia with 76 doubles and 8 home runs. I mean,
that's it.
That is it. So they're just a good hitting team. They do everything well. They don't have a glaring weakness. That's why they are 31-3. And I'm telling you, get ready for them to have some just stupid record. It's going to happen. Looking at their schedule, they've been through the toughest part. Meanwhile, North Carolina, I think we were both on the same tip with the Tar Heels that, yeah, they played well. I think we were still a little skeptical about their ability to score runs. Their offense has been so prolific this year. But to go on the road and win a series at Florida State, Aaron, is very, very difficult. And North Carolina just keeps they have some problems on Sundays. Their bullpen bailed them out on Sunday this week. But offensively, is it safe to say North Carolina's – are they the best offensive team in the ACC?
Boy, they just might be. I mean, they've sure performed like it at this point. That was a statement weekend for me. You know, I mean, I think we both thought we were a little bit light on North Carolina. But we wanted to see what would happen this weekend. This was a major litmus test for them. They hadn't won a series of Florida State since 1995. You know, that's 16 years ago. So to go down there and take 2 out of 3 is huge. I believe in their offense at this point. You know, I think you have to. Colin Moran is clearly the real deal as a freshman. You know, he's having and Dustin Ackley kind of an impact as a freshman. You know, I mean, I really like Jacob Stallings and the step forward he's taken as a junior. I've heard lots of good things about Levi Michael. You know, and Ben Bunting at the top is a nice catalyst. They've got a veteran in there with Jesse Weirs-Bickey. And then they've got some young guys who've done a good job as well. So, I mean, it's a good lineup. You talked about the problems they've had on Sundays. It's been a little bit up and down with their Sunday starters, but the bullpen bailed them out. And that's one of the strengths of this team is it's a deep bullpen. It's a deeper bullpen than they've had before in a long time. You know, so I think they're a legitimate contender now. And now they've got a stranglehold, I think. Not a stranglehold, but they're certainly in the driver's seat for a national seed, which is, I think, the biggest development this weekend. In our Field of 64 projection last week, we still had Florida State as a national seed over North Carolina because I expected Florida State to win this home series and kind of use that as a springboard in the ACC. But, you know, North Carolina goes down there and wins that thing 2 out of 3. All of a sudden, it's reversed. I think Carolina is clearly in position to get a national seed.
Yeah, I think that one of the big other keys for North Carolina, they lead the ACC in runs. So, you know, that's not the only measure because you're talking about who you schedule has an impact on that. But they do lead the ACC in runs. So that's one way to say they're the best offense in the league. The other key for them, I think, is their weekend rotation has been a little bit better than we thought. Their bullpen's better. But Patrick Johnson, I don't think either one of us was really convinced that this was a true Friday guy. He's a senior. That helps. He's been better than he's ever been this year. He's averaging a strikeout per inning. He's taken a huge step forward, and I think we both knew they had to have someone else come through in their weekend rotation, and Kent Emanuel's really, you know, pitched very well in general for them this year. He might be a little bit much to ask him to be the Saturday guy necessarily, but you can't argue with the results. He's been quite good. So, but Patrick Johnson, I think, deserves some mention, and I will remind you that he is a personal cheese ball of mine. I've always been a PJ guy. Speaking of short right-handers, we have a couple of email questions on the podcast on our Twitter account. Aaron, PSL to Flushing, who always asks, we're going to transition a little bit to the Pac-10. PSL to Flushing asks, Trevor Bauer, a top 15 pick for you, or is the concern about workload or mechanics too much? I think you know my answer. I want to hear your answer on Trevor Bauer.
He's certainly a top 15 pick, and I think he's got a real chance to go inside the top 10. And, you know, I think he's a top 5 talent. It's just a matter of, you know, who's going to pull the trigger in the top 5. He is a little unconventional, but I'm not worried about the workload. You know, there's been a little bit of a kerfuffle, I guess, on Twitter. Is that the right word, John?
I think kerfuffle is absolutely the correct word.
So people on the internet are starting to clamor about Bauer's pitch counts. But look, I mean, it's, you know, he's, for one thing, he's a very different case. He he throws a lot, you know, and he's one of those guys who likes to throw a lot. You can't treat all pitchers the same way, and I'm not going to get bent out of shape about a guy who throws 130 pitches thrown once a week. You know, I think it's him especially, he can handle it. I don't think there's anything to worry about there.
Yeah, I mean, for me, his whole point is that he conditions himself to pitch a lot, and he wants to pitch a lot. And he told people last year, give me to 100 pitches, and I'll get you there. I mean, if you were concerned about that with Tim Lincecum, you'll be concerned about it with Trevor Bauer. There's no other way to put it. The first time I saw Bauer as a freshman, I was startled because he's such a Lincecum imitator. I mean, it's startling just how similar his delivery is. He's clearly patterned himself after Lincecum. Not a bad guy to pattern yourself after, Aaron, if you're a smaller pitcher. He long tosses like crazy. He clearly, we all saw, I wrote about it last year in Omaha, the way that he prepares himself. He's prepared to throw a lot. And and he's much more efficient in college than Tim Lincecum ever was. So he's frankly more advanced. I think he's slightly less electric. I think I'm not giving him enough credit when I say he's less electric than Lincecum. I don't see the difference, to be honest with you, between him and Lincecum, except that Lincecum has a more hellacious breaking ball, maybe, than Bauer. But Bauer's changeup at a similar stage, it's much more advanced than Lincecum. Lincecum really didn't break the changeup out until he was a big leaguer.
Yeah.
So for me, if you like Tim Lincecum, you'll love Trevor Bauer. And I think Lincecum's success will help Trevor Bauer. And I don't mean to sound cynical, but if I were a major league club, all I'm looking at is, will Trevor Bauer hold up physically while he's cheap? And I don't care if he has a 10- or 15-year career. I care, is he going to be good while he's cheap? And I have a lot of confidence that he will be good while he's cheap. I'll tell you another guy we talked about workload-wise in college was Mike Leake. Mike Leake, similarly small, athletic, like Trevor Bauer, threw a lot of pitches, efficient, but went deep into games constantly. My only concern with Mike Leake coming out of college was durability, and he's been durable. He skipped the minor leagues, went straight to the big leagues, and helped the Reds win the division last year. So, to me, the success of Mike Leake and Tim Lincecum both help Trevor Bauer, and people who have the problem with the pitch count can wear it on when Trevor Bauer's big time in the major leagues, because I have absolutely no concern because he's not conventional. That's exactly why
that's right.
I have no concerns. So, good question. But I think it's like you said, the kerfuffle is much ado about nothing. And then Kowloon WC, alias Ian Miller, asks, the prognosis for Cal's reinstated program, how's the recruiting overcome this, and how long before they compete again, Aaron? Let's go right into that. I mean, Cal dropped down in our rankings this week from 13 to 16. The Bears lost a series at Arizona. So the Wildcats moved up from 22 to 20. But Cal reinstated last week. The baseball's been on this yo-yo all spring. They're gone. They're in. They're out. They're in. They're out. Pick one and stick with it. Finally, they raised $10 million. I think, is it fair to say, Aaron, that both you and I think that the university wanted to get rid of baseball?
I think so. Yeah, I really do. And you know, in the end, they were presented with too much money and they couldn't do it. But take that, Chancellor. You know,
that's it. That's it.
But I'll tell you, it's going to be interesting to see how this whole thing affects them long term. It's a great question. We don't know the answer, but I do know that, you know, as recently as a month ago, they were looking and trying to find new places for their players to land after the season. And now to go from that to, okay, guys, you know, stay put and let's go out and recruit. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how they recover from it. It's interesting. I wonder how it'll affect their recruiting. You know, for now, I think they'll worry about that later. I think they're just a sigh of relief is the appropriate response.
Do you think they had any letdown at all this weekend as a team, where they've been so focused on, let's show those sons of bitches that we just did this, that they can try to eliminate us and we're going to go to Omaha? Do you think they lost any edge for this year's team with the reinstatement?
I mean, I wouldn't think so. You never know. I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, it's without being inside the program, it's hard to know, but I, you know, to me, it seems like this team is very well coached and driven and focused. And they've got some older guys that are stabilizers. And, you know, I think they're going to keep on playing well, even without that particular motivation. I mean, I think they've got plenty of motivation, and now they can relax a little bit, and you'd have to think it would eventually help them. But, you know, I think this weekend was just a case of you know, losing a road series to a very talented team, and I like Arizona's team. You know, I think that the resume, you know, had some holes in it until this weekend, but talent-wise, I really like their team.
Yeah, I agree. I think the one thing you do look at Cal, they do have some talent in the underclassmen, and including my new favorite Cal player, Michael Theofanopoulos, attaboy, Yasu Mikhaili. But it's a junior-dominated team, Aaron. I would expect them to take a pretty decent step back next year. Yeah. And it would not shock me if Cal were forced to go the JUCO route. I don't know how easy it is to get in from a JUCO into the University of California at Berkeley. I would assume it's not easy. But it wouldn't shock me if Dan Hubbs and Dan Esker and that coaching staff was forced to go the JUCO route a little bit. But stick in the Pac-10, Aaron. You mentioned Arizona, big series win. We've talked a little bit about UCLA. Who's the best team in the Pac-10 right now, Aaron? Stanford lost a series at Southern Cal. Arizona State got swept by Oregon State. Is it the O-State Ballers? They were balling this weekend.
Yeah, it might be the Beavers. You know, it really might be because they're good. As we talked about, I think they're really good in the mound. I mean, I like the 1-2 punch with Sam Gavilio and Josh Osich. I like their bullpen. But the biggest thing for Oregon State, the key, is that they're a lot better offensively than they were last year.
Yep.
You know, and they're scoring runs. They scored 7 and 9 runs in the last two games to win that series against a very stingy Arizona State pitching staff. You know, I like the middle of their lineup, even without Susak. And that's the other thing. They did this weekend without their best hitter, Andrew Susak.
I was about to say, that's the amazing part to me is that Andrew Susak might be out for the year with this broken hammock, and they still put up runs on Arizona State. It's kind of a stunning development.
It's very impressive, you know. I mean, and you know, guys like Jared Norris and Danny Hayes have really emerged for them in the middle of the lineup. And they're kind of like Virginia. You know, they're a gap team. They're a line drive gap team. You know, they've just taken a huge step forward offensively. And I don't know. I mean, maybe they are the best team in the Pac-10. I think the Pac-10 is wide open right now. You know, I would have said certainly that Arizona State was the best team in the league heading into this weekend. And I don't know if you can say that anymore. You know, they just got swept. So we'll see. I mean, there's a lot of baseball left to be played in the Pac-10, but I really like the top six teams in that league, and I wouldn't be surprised to see them finish in a lot of different orders.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the SEC and the ACC have some separation now. Virginia is clearly the best team in the ACC. I don't think there's a doubt about that. I think North Carolina has the next best case, but I don't think they're that much different from Georgia Tech and Florida State. But I think we know that's the top four, but Virginia's one. The SEC, as we talked about, top three, everybody else. You know, you can throw the rest of those teams in a hat, and right now you'd pick Georgia out as the fourth best team, I'd say. But the Pac-10 is completely wide open, and I'd feel really good about Oregon State if Susak were healthy, but I kind of wonder their staying power without him at the top of that lineup. It's the Baseball America podcast with John Manuel and Aaron Fitt. Dang it, Aaron, I love talking college baseball on a Monday. It's just – there's so much good stuff going on. In the Big 12, that league seems a little bit more muddled than some of the other leagues. But to me, Texas and Texas A&M are the top two teams, but they don't seem like they have as much distance as those top teams, the other teams that we're talking about. Is that fair? I mean, like, Oklahoma's been a little bit of a disappointment this year so far. You know, and Texas and A&M don't excite you, but they pitch and they play defense and they keep on grinding out series wins.
That's it. Yep. I mean, those two teams are very similar, the way they're constructed. You know, both teams have power first round guys at the top of the rotation, with Youngman and Stilson. You know, you've got a first round guy next year on Saturday with Michael Wacha at A&M, and maybe a first rounder in Hobie Milner next year on Saturday for Texas. So, and then you know on Sunday it's a couple upperclassmen, Cole Green and Ross Stripling. They're both pitching teams is what they are, and they have to play defense and they have to manufacture runs, and then they've been able to grind out a lot of wins. And you know there's like we've talked about, there's a bunch of teams in our top 10 that are kind of built this way, and those two teams do it as well as anybody, you know. And Oklahoma by contrast is more of an offensive team in theory, but they've been up and down offensively. You know, they started out really hot And then they went through a cold patch where they weren't scoring runs for about 2 weeks. And now they they scored a bunch of runs last weekend. And then this weekend they score a bunch of runs on Saturday, but not on Friday and Sunday. So, it's hard to figure out Oklahoma at this point. I don't, besides Michael Rocha going out there every Friday and giving you a strong start, I don't know what else to expect from that team. So we'll learn more about them this weekend at Oklahoma State. That should be a bedlam over there in Stillwater.
Well played. No, well played. I mean, I am curious. I'm sure that his pitch counts are less than Trevor Bauer's, but, Taylor Youngman, is there any kerfuffle about him? He's got more, in my mind, questionable mechanics than Trevor Bauer does with his little kind of head snap at the end of his delivery, and he's gone 7, 8, 9 innings every start this year. Is there any Twitter kerfuffle about him? I mean,
not that I've heard.
He has been ridiculous this year. But he's much less dominant in terms of strikeouts than Trevor Bauer. So I assume he's a little bit more efficient, but I mean, he's going deep in every game too. Taylor Youngman, he was a midseason first team All-American, correct? Didn't we put him on that first team?
Yes.
I mean, this guy, to me, he might be as good as John Stilson is. Taylor Youngman might be the difference that makes me think if I had to pick a team, Texas or A&M in the Big 12, I might pick the Longhorns just because I do like they're a little bit more left-handed than A&M, correct? On the mound?
They've got Cole Green, I guess, he's a righty. I mean,
right.
Hobie Milner, I'm sorry. That's what I'm thinking of.
Both Sam Stafford and Hobie Milner from the left side.
Yeah.
And I like Corey, is it Knable, their third?
Corey Knable, yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing that was really, for me, who was going to replace Chance Ruffin, who was so good out of the bullpen for Texas last year. But Knable's been outstanding. He's been pretty dominant. So if I had to pick a team for the rest of the year, I might give a slight edge, I guess, to the Longhorns over the Aggies. But, hey, the Aggies do have that national championship in women's basketball, so there is that. Obviously.
It's worth mentioning from a scheduling standpoint that Texas has Oklahoma at home, and two out of the three games against A&M are in Austin. So the schedule, I think, favors Texas a little bit too. I'm with you. I probably would take Texas.
Another thing is that in A&M's favor, in a serious note, is they already went to Oklahoma and won that series. That's why they're ranked ahead right now. They have the best chit at the table is there. They just push that out there. Series win on the road at Oklahoma, call. Aaron, a couple other things from the rankings. A lot of churn at the back. Fresno State dropped a little bit. They dropped out of the top 10. We had a lot of churn at the back, but we didn't end up bringing in any of these other teams. We have Troy 18 now, Stetson 21. Troy and Stetson, let's touch on those two teams a little bit because I don't think we've talked about them in the podcast before, except in passing. What chances do Troy and Stetson have? Being ranked is all well and good. What chances do those teams have of hosting a regional?
They both have realistic chances, and they're both in the top 25, 27 in the RPI right now. We'll see how that holds as the season progresses, but I think those leagues are good enough that, they could be in the mix. Geographically, it's tough with all those teams in the Southeast. You have to figure Florida and Florida State are locks to host. If you're Stetson, are you competing for another spot in that state, in that region, with maybe Miami? I mean, Miami's kind of backdooring their way into a hosting discussion as well all of a sudden. I mean, they're doing pretty well in the ACC, and they're 28 in the RPI, and their RPI is probably going to wind up at the end of the year better than Stetson's. So that's something to think about. You've got all those SEC teams in Georgia and Alabama, and it's going to be tricky, I think, for those teams geographically to beat out the SEC teams for hosting spots, because all those SEC ACC teams are going to be better in the RPI. So those teams, really, there's not a lot of margin for error for Stetson and Troy, but boy, they sure look like the class of their respective conferences. And if they can keep this up, I mean, they're both 25-6, 25-7 right now. That's a great start. If you have a gaudy record, the committee likes that, and I think that they can host, but they can't really afford to trip up too much.
Yeah, and I think that it's pretty telling when you look at the RPI needs report on BoydsWorld.com, one of the resources I think everybody in college baseball uses. You look at Stetson; they have to go 23-0. To finish in the top 16 in the RPI. I think that the better Georgia plays, the more that helps Stetson. I don't think it's all on that one weekend, but the fact they swept an SEC team is going to really help them as long as Georgia keeps on playing well. I know Stetson's ballpark is pretty nice. I don't remember what their capacity is, but I do remember that it's an impressive ballpark. It's fairly new. I know Chipper Jones has helped donate some money there. He's from that area, right around there. His dad, Larry Sr., was actually, Chipper's a chip off the old block. But that's but Larry Sr. was an assistant coach at Stetson for a time, if he's not still involved with the program in some way. So I know they have a nice ballpark. You know, Troy this weekend drew between 15,000 and 2,000 in every game against Florida International, which is, good. I'm not sure. I think Stetson has a better shot, I guess I'm saying, to host. And even then, that's tough because, like you said, you're talking about Florida State and Florida are both looking like hosts as well, pretty much the same geographic footprint. But Troy, if Alabama or Auburn doesn't host, maybe you get Troy. Maybe they could sneak in as a one seed and Alabama or Auburn as a two seed. It's tough. If those teams, if Stetson's a two seed, they're going to Gainesville or Florida State, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, so I actually think it's more realistic for Troy. Plus, the Sun Belt's a better league than the Atlantic Sun. It's more likely to be a multiple bid league. It's more likely in my mind that Troy could squeeze in there just from a geography standpoint. And their ballpark, I don't know much about their ballpark. It seems like they draw, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 max. I'm not sure that it's really a regional host ballpark, but it seems like it's more likely that the champion of the Sun Belt could sneak in at the back and be a one seed. They've got to go 22-1 down the stretch to be in that top 16 in RPI. So I think it's unlikely, no matter how high they rise in our rankings. But I think we do need to watch what happens in the SEC too, because to me there's a lot of mediocrity in that league. And just because they're in the SEC, I don't think it's automatic their teams' RPIs are going to keep rising, as long as teams at the bottom like Tennessee, Kentucky, Auburn, to a lesser extent LSU, those teams' records are all pretty mediocre, Aaron. So maybe they don't rise up there. Is there another team?
But John, I mean, you look at Auburn, still 16 in the RPI. Tennessee and Kentucky aren't. Those teams are lower. You're right. So I mean, maybe you're right about that. But Mississippi State. I mean, all those teams are in the top 30.
Okay, but if Auburn goes 8-16, they're still in the top 45 in the rankings. But that, I think 8-16 down the stretch is plausible for Auburn. I'm not hating on Auburn. I'm just saying it's plausible because they're playing other good teams. So if they go 12-12 in there, they're not necessarily going to rise. They're going to come down the RPI, is what I'm saying. Like, if they go 10-14, they're still in the top 32 according to Boyd's World. That means they aren't going to stay 16 if they don't win games. That's my point.
Right.
They're not going to stay there unless they win games. So the teams that win games in the SEC will stay high in the RPI. The teams that lose some games are going to they won't stay in the top 20 if they don't play better. That's all I'm saying.
Sure.
So, and that's how it should be. That's fair. Any teams outside our rankings, Aaron, that you think have a legit shot to host? Like if Michigan State, which swept Minnesota this weekend and is the best team in the Big Ten, does Michigan State have a chance to host? Last I recall, they used to play a lot of home games, even in Lansing, at the home of the Lansing Lugnuts, or a team like Creighton, where you'll be in a couple weeks for the opener at TD Ameritrade Field. Does Creighton have a chance? Like, could they host a regional at TD Ameritrade? That'd be wild. Talk about a warm-up for the College World Series. What are the chances of teams outside our top 25 hosting regionals?
Well, those two examples that you brought up, I mean, I don't see happening. You never know. I mean, we've learned certainly that the committee likes to put regionals in the north and in new places and grow the game. But I just don't see either of those teams, finishing with a gaudy enough record and a strong enough resume to get a host. I mean, if they do, it would be as a two seed for sure. But I'm still not convinced that Creighton is going to, run away with the Missouri Valley Conference. I still think Wichita and Illinois State, have a lot to do with that. And give Creighton credit for winning a road series at Illinois State this weekend. That's a big series for them to start conference play. I think that conference is going to wind up being pretty close. And that being the case, I don't think you're going to have a host out of that league. And Big Ten is just down this year. You know, I mean, it's I do agree, you know, certainly that Michigan State is the best team in that league. Maybe they could sneak a host as number two, but I think it's going to be hard because their league is so down. It's hard for them to really build up their RPI.
I'm going to tell you what, Wichita State was my preseason Omaha sleeper. That's been a disappointing team. They're 124 in the RPI at 21-13. Now, I think that's a joke that their RPI is that low because, yeah, they have North Dakota State and Niagara, but they've also played a series at Tulane. They played Arizona. They played Penn State, which they lost that series, but Penn State even has a couple of decent series wins. NC State and Wichita State are decent series wins. They played at Oregon. They played at Hawaii. And that's not a bad RPI schedule. I think what's killing them is they played Alcorn State a couple times, and I guess North Dakota and Niagara must have really, really bad RPIs. Yep, Niagara's 4-25. There you go. So North Dakota 1-18. You know, the RPI is fickle, and all your good series could get canceled out by your bad series. I'm still stunned that a team that in my mind has played a lot of competitive series, Aaron, is down at 124 with their record, with their RPI. But that Missouri Valley Conference is looking like a one-bid league. It's looking like a tournament league, unless Creighton really dominates the regular season and then loses, you know, the tournament, which is just I think of that as a two-bid league. In my mind, that should be a two-bid league, maybe in a good year, three-bid league. It's looking like a one-bid league.
It hasn't been a multiple-bid league in a while. I feel like it's usually, over the last half decade or so at least, it's been a one-bid league.
Okay.
So whether it deserves to be or not is another story, but it's usually one-bid league.
Yeah, it was a three-bid league back in the day a couple times, but that was a different committee, and the committee definitely looks at things differently than it does now than it has in the past. Anybody from the Big East that you think has a chance to host a regional? UConn has righted itself somewhat, at least in the league. They probably righted themselves because they're in the league. Louisville have a chance to host a regional?
You know, I mean, if they get hot, you know, maybe. But, I mean, it's – I don't know. They're 51 in the RPI. They're – you know, Boyd says they need to go 21-4 just to finish in the top 32 in the RPI. So, I mean, I don't see it happening. I don't think that you're going to see a Big East team host. I really think this is one of those years where you're not going to see too many unconventional hosts. I think we're mostly going to see power conferences hosts. Even a team like TCU, I wonder – if they're going to have trouble hosting, you know, because they're, you know, they're 34th in the RPI. They'd have to go 24-1 to finish in the top 16, according to the needs report. That's not easy, you know, and certainly they could host with a lower RPI than that. But, you know, they probably need to get pretty hot because there's a lot of competition for hosting spots in that region. And, you know, Rice is a factor still, and, you know, the Big 12 teams. And so, you know, I don't know that you're going to see a lot of teams outside the power conferences hosting this year.
I think you nailed it. I think you're right. I think Troy is the most likely team because they're in a multiple bid league, potentially anyway. And if Auburn and Alabama don't host, at least Troy can kind of fill that geographic void. But again, I'm not sure stadium-wise and history-wise that Troy is kind of a new team where they look. So we'll see what happens. But I think, Aaron, it's shaping up as – some nice stories out there, but I think you're going to look at powered conference teams that are going to host, and it's going to be more likely that a team like Oklahoma or Oklahoma State, you know, the winner of that series this weekend has got a good shot to host. I think they could be one of those back of the 16, 16 host sites, or a team like Fresno State if they win the WAC. And you could see a regional at Fresno State. So those are more likely. Fresno State's probably the non-power conference, and Fullerton – hosts. Everybody else is going to be, I think, ACC, SEC, Pac-10, Big 12.
And even Fresno needs to finish really strong because of the RPI. I mean, as much as I think the WAC is pretty solid this year, you know, according to the needs report, they need to go 23-1 to finish in that top 16. So
yeah, I don't think they dig the top 16 teams as your regional host. Fresno does draw. They have some history. They've had successful regionals in the past, but they better win the WAC regular season.
Absolutely.
And, you know, to host. And I'm gonna say he's even just as far as chances to host outside those top six, outside those power conferences, that list is the short list. I completely agree with you. So, great podcast, Aaron. Anything else you want to talk about?
That'll do it for me, John. I thought it was a very compelling week in college baseball. A lot of series, five series between ranked teams this weekend. You had, I think, 10 teams in the rankings that lost the series, as opposed to last week when 23 out of your 25 teams won series. So it was an interesting week. I think we're starting to get some crystallization, and you know, it's going to be a fun second half.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm finally a little bit more geeked for college baseball. Maybe the end of college basketball helped, you know, with that. I've always been interested, but now I'm pretty geeked about it. It didn't hurt to drive and see Anthony Rendon on Saturday. I wish that East Carolina had pitched to him more than once, but I will tell you, Mike Wright looked pretty good going up against Anthony Rendon on Saturday, striking him out with a 96-mile-an-hour fastball. We could have done a draft podcast. We'll probably do one later this week because we will have a midseason draft update, but we could have talked draft. In fact, I think we intended to talk draft during the podcast and didn't. But I'll tell you, it would have been pretty hard to scout Anthony Rendon this weekend and any weekend when he's constantly getting intentionally walked and you know, not getting pitched to. And when he is getting pitched to, he's a little banged up and not even taking – he's taking infield, but he's not throwing. Doesn't look like he's going to return to third base anytime soon. And Conference USA, we didn't talk about in the podcast, Aaron. We won't talk about it this week, but needless to say, that league is as muddied as ever after we thought Southern Miss had kind of taken some charge in that league. So plenty more compelling stuff to talk about on next week's podcast. So for Aaron Fitt, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America College podcast. Until then, so long, everybody.